News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In the drama over this year's state budget, one more step has been completed as New Hampshire House members on Wednesday approved an $11 billion tax and spending plan. Now the state Senate takes center stage, and its approach will be quite different from the House version. For one, the House budget includes no revenues from a new casino, which the Senate and governor want. The House plan would also increase taxes on gasoline and on tobacco, and it delays the start of several new business tax breaks passed by the previous legislature. Senate Republican leaders say they're not wild about these and other aspects of the House plan. Senate Finance Chair Chuck Morse told the union leader his committee will take a fresh look at the budget. Meanwhile, this week outside the legislature, the governor nominated former state senator Joe Foster for attorney general. Manchester and Nashua learned that more refugees were due to arrive in their cities. And speaking in New Hampshire, former Massachusetts U.S. Senator Scott Brown wouldn't rule out a run for U.S. Senate here. Today in The Exchange, it's a New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're looking at some of the top stories Granite Staters were talking about this week. And let's hear from you this hour. What are some of the issues in state news that you want to know more about that happened this week? What issues are front and center right now in your mind? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like. exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Today we have three guests with us in studio. Dean Spiliotis is here, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Ben Loopsdorf, staff reporter at the Concord Monitor covering New Hampshire politics and state government. And Ben, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
That's great to be here.
Also with us, Josh Rogers, NHPR State House reporter and senior political reporter and editor. And Josh, thanks for your time.
No problem, Laura.
Well, and Josh, I want to start with you. Senator Chuck Morse, the finance chair, made it quite clear that he's going to take a fresh look at the budget. What's he trying to say there?
Well, I think he's trying to say what he's been saying all along, is that the Senate's going to take its own approach, and that approach is going to include a casino, and that approach is not likely to include a gas tax. You know, there's always a push and pull. We're at the midway part of the session. The House has done its work. The Senate will do its work. And, then we'll see if they can come to terms at the end of the year. But Senator Morse's reaction to the House budget was not at all surprising. And, but to some degree, the Senate does have its work cut out for it in terms of getting gambling, because the House has historically opposed it, and House budget writers did a pretty good job of crafting a plan that preserved a lot of Governor Hassan's priorities on the social spending, and did so without the $80 million in casino licensing fees. And so it'll be interesting to see how the Senate looks to get the revenue in, and whether that means beating back some of the revenue assumptions the House made, or so essentially making the case that we can't afford the spending in these areas, that there's consensus around that there ought to be money spent. So we'll see. We've got weeks to go until July 1.
Right. June 6 is when the Senate has to have its plan completed.
Yes.
And just listening to the language, Josh, from the finance leaders in the Senate versus the finance leaders in the House, it sounds almost like they're still debating the last session and the last budget. You heard House budget writers say, and this is their language, we're restoring some of the devastation from the last session. Whereas Chuck Morse said, we're going to live within our means and keep some of the reforms that we did last time around.
That was one thing that was interesting. I mean, listening to the floor debate in the House is the degree to which the present state budget, hung over the discussion. For Democrats, it was always cast, and, Cindy Rosenwald, the vice chair of the Finance Committee, said that this is a modest restoration of some of the devastating cuts made in the last budget. Democrats were invoking former House Speaker Bill O'Brien in talking points, which prompted him to take to the floor. And he said he wasn't planning to sort of lead the fight this time around, but only did so because he was invoked in these talking points. He's also, looking at a run for Congress. But, he took to the floor and said, I will show you what's in a good budget. And, this budget, spends too much, taxes too much, and, undoes what he says is the positive progress in the last budget. And one that, was interesting. I mean, you compare to the scene at the State House during the House budget from 2 years ago, and it was interesting. There were union protesters. There were, you know, members of the clergy. There were, you know, shouting in the gallery. You know, this time there was none of that, but it was still, you know, Bill O'Brien in the thick of it. So it was
interesting. Well, and Josh outlined some of the particulars, but Ben, to you too. So what are some of the biggest differences between what the House did and what the Senate might do? I mean, Josh outlined them, but give us a little more detail. Tobacco taxes, for example.
Yeah, so one of the big things that the House did in its budget was that they kept the 30-cent increase in the tobacco tax that Maggie Hassan had proposed in her budget, and they added in a 12-cent increase in the gas tax phased in over 3 years for gas, 6 years for diesel. That had previously passed the House as a separate bill. They added it in. Dan Eaton, who's a representative from Stoddard, who's the chairman of one of the Finance Committee's subcommittees called Divisions, said that this was a belt and suspenders measure, but it adds one more tax increase into the budget. They also increased a handful of fees. Most of those are probably going to run into trouble in the Senate. Chuck Morse, again, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, has said these are revenues that the state can't count on and that the Senate won't accept. One of the other things he pointed out that he didn't like about the House budget is the Medicaid enhancement tax revenues. This is a somewhat complex tax that the state has, but in short, he believes that those estimates are far too high, both in Governor Hassan's budget and in the House budget, somewhere in the area of $70 million. So that's an area where the Senate Ways and Means Committee, which deals with tax and revenue issues, is going to be taking a look at those numbers, coming up with its own estimates of revenue. The Senate, of course, has much more information to work with than the House did. They're coming into this later in the process, so they have more revenues to look at to make perhaps more accurate estimates for the next 2 years.
I want to ask Dean you about that as well, but also invite our listeners to join us. The number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. It's a weekly New Hampshire news roundup today in the exchange. We want to hear from you. What are some of the issues in state news that you'd like to know more about, that you heard about this week, and what issues are most important in your mind right now? The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Dean Spiliotis, you know, Ben makes an important point. It's not just about the particulars, you know, this tax or that tax, this spending cut or that spending cut. These debates are about the underlying assumptions that folks make as they enter this whole budget writing process.
Absolutely. And what I find so fascinating about what's happening right now in the State House is it's really kind of a microcosm of what we see at the national level in terms of appropriations. Just the parties are reversed, right? In New Hampshire, we have a Democratic House, Republican Senate. In the U.S. Congress, we have a Republican House and a Democratic Senate. So part of the differences we're seeing between the two chambers in terms of the assumptions, in terms of the underlying focus of the budget writing, you know, are kind of a function of these ideological differences. You look at New Hampshire, and we have a budget that has passed the House largely along party lines. All Republicans opposed it. Only 5 Democrats voted against it. It has a couple of taxes in it that Republicans in the Senate have said are regressive. It doesn't have the casino gambling money that the Republicans in the Senate say they want. So it really is kind of an interesting reflection of why budget writing in general has become so difficult under divided government. So, you know, part of it is that's just how the process works. And I think Josh mentioned this in his comments that, you know, there's another 2 months for the Senate to work on it. Then it'll go to the conference. Conference committee hearings are notorious for all kinds of horse trading and slipping things in and out of the budget at the last minute. But I do think the whole process here has been constrained by the fact that each chamber is controlled by a different party with a different kind of underlying set of ideas about the role of state government, about the role of revenue, about the role of state government in terms of creating an environment for job creation. So those are pretty significant differences. A lot of it, you know, some of it is posturing, but we really are onto almost a sort of a fresh round of budget creation, and then we'll see what happens in June.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ben. You want to jump back in?
Well, and going back to the assumptions part a little bit, it's not just on the revenue side. It's also on the spending side. One of the ways that the House Finance Committee cut money out of the budget to account for the loss of gambling revenue was looking at caseloads at the Department of Health and Human Services. They assumed lower caseloads than Governor Hassan's budget had expected. That saved them about $10 million. Again, those are based on assumptions.
They're and that assuming, may or may not happen.
It's assuming that the economy is going to get better and fewer people are going to be seeking welfare. Whether that comes true or not is going to be one of the things that will determine whether this budget is in the end balanced.
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You know, one of the other interesting things for me, Josh, coming out of all the discussion back and forth between the House and the Senate, was the Senate actually, in a couple instances, was upset that the House had made some budget cuts. Now, where and why were they upset? For example, they were upset about the loss of money for charter schools.
Well, certainly, and that gets back to the partisan differences, obviously. The charter school issue has become a little less fraught than it has been historically. But, it's safe to say that, Republicans have traditionally been supportive to the idea of creating more competition within the public school system and more choice for students and families. Democrats have been leery. And you look at the perennial funding issues for public schools, and you can understand why in New Hampshire this debate has been a little bit more fractious than it has been in some other states. But that's something that Governor Hassan had put money in for charter schools, and the House has taken it out. And essentially, as it stands now, if the House's policy were to be a standard, essentially be a moratorium on charter schools, for the next 2 years, we can expect that money to be reintroduced, and we can certainly expect the debate over the elimination of the tax credit program for allowing business to get tax credits for scholarships. That's something that's going to flare in the Senate after the House voted to repeal that policy.
Yeah, Dean, jump in.
Yeah, it's interesting. We talk about kind of the party line nature of the vote in the House, and I think Republicans introduced something like 16 amendments to the budget in the House to try to change a few of the particulars. They were all defeated by voice votes. But things like lowering the tobacco tax from 30 cents down to 20 cents. There was an attempt to put in a moratorium on transmission lines and wind projects, which is the Northern Pass and wind farm debate that's been going on. And also this issue of trying to protect some of the funds that what we call dedicated funds, that are money is raised through revenues for a particular area. And in theory, it's supposed to be protected. Fish and Game is one example of that. LCHIP, the Heritage Conservation Fund. Governors have a tradition of raiding those funds. And, Governor Hassan, like others, wants maximum flexibility to sweep those funds for extra money. And the Republicans were trying to stop that. That was defeated as well.
All right. We will talk a lot more after a short break. And take your calls, too. 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. NHPR brings you the news every day, all year long. News from around the world, across the country, and throughout the state. Breaking news, developing stories, weather and sports. NHPR, keeping New Hampshire connected. More of our New Hampshire News Roundup coming up on The Exchange. And at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. Becoming mostly sunny across New Hampshire today, highs around 45 north of the mountains, 50 for the Lakes region and Upper Valley area, 50 to 55 degrees from Concord southward. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Unity Homes from Bensonwood, designed to improve the world by enhancing quality of life and reducing energy consumption. Information at unityhomes.com. And from Vintage Kitchens of Concord, enduring designs that balance clients' needs with the home's architectural features. Online at vintagekitchens.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's a weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're talking about some of the latest news, not just from the State House, but also around the state. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. So far, we've talked about some of the differences in budgeting between the House and Senate. The House finished its work this week. Its budget includes increased gas taxes, increased cigarette taxes, delays, some tax breaks passed by the last legislature. The Senate has made it clear it is not wild about these and some other aspects of the House plan. Senate promises to take a fresh look at the budget. We'd like your thoughts, questions, and comments on this at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. One more time, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Ben Lubsdorf, one thing we haven't talked about yet that did get a lot of play in the last election is university funding, cut pretty deeply by the last legislature. It was a huge campaign platform for Maggie Hassan when she ran for governor to restore university funding. The House went along, but not all the way.
No, that's right. And this was something that Maggie Hassan campaigned on a lot, and Governor Hassan included something like 90% of what had been cut back into the budget in terms of state aid to the university system. Now, this only makes up a small portion of the actual budget for the university system, but it's one of the things that the university system pointed to, this dramatic cut in aid, something like cutting it in half in the last budget, as one of the reasons tuition spiked so much. So the House looked at that. They ended up trimming about $12 million over the biennium out of what Maggie Hassan had proposed for the university system. That still means that the universities would get a lot more money than they had in the current budget. But it's less than they had hoped for. It's less than she had hoped for. The big carrot that's been held out by the universities has been the idea of a tuition freeze for in-state students. They've said that under Governor Hassan's budget, they would be able to freeze tuition. They haven't said that about the House version, though they haven't said one way or another on that.
I asked President Huddleston about that a couple weeks back, and you're right. He was noncommittal whether he would still be able to do that under the House version. Dean, did you want to jump in real quick?
This is a very interesting issue. Every time I talk to state legislators about this issue, it comes back around to this idea that, yes, they want more money for UNH, but there's also a sense that the university system has not done enough on its own to kind of reform its bureaucratic processes, that it's inefficient, and it'd be fine to have a tuition freeze, but particularly Republican legislators have wanted more evidence that the university is working to increase efficiency so that the money is just not kind of wasted on bureaucratic overhead. So that comes back time and again in terms of more comfort with community college money, but less comfort with kind of the overarching university system because of this kind of, bureaucratic process issue.
Well, and speaking of community colleges, Josh, I think they saw their funding remain between the governor's budget and the House budget.
Indeed.
They're in good stead these days budget-wise. Let's take some calls, gentlemen. Our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Join our news roundup today at 1-800-892-6477. First up is Chris in Nashua. Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious to find out how much money goes in, respectively, to these heritage and conservation funds and how much gets taken out for their intended purposes, spent appropriately, and how much is essentially, misappropriated to close budget gaps.
Yeah, and are there any ones of these dedicated funds, Chris, that you care in particular about? We've heard a lot from supporters of these dedicated funds recently.
No, I actually am new to the issue, so I don't have any preference. I'm just concerned about, people, voluntarily donate to these things, and then they get taken out for other purposes, so it doesn't seem like a very honest way to conduct business, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and thanks a lot, Chris. Now, just to clarify, Josh, sometimes people donate, like the Moose Plate, for example. That's a donation, but in other instances, it's a fee or a tax that you pay when you buy license X, Y, or Z.
Exactly. And he mentioned the LCHIP program, and that's something that has been an interesting issue to follow through the years. It was something that passed with overwhelming support, when it passed the House, it was under Republican House Speaker Donna Sitek. It was, I forget the precise vote, but it was close to unanimous vote in the House, and it included actually real appropriations from the state to matching grants for local conservation and historic preservation efforts. But historically, budget writers have raided monies, and one way to solve that situation was that they said, okay, we're going to come up with a funding source, which is going to be on real estate transfer deeds, and there's going to be a fee, and still it's been raided. To be honest, I don't know precisely the status of LCHIP in this budget and where we're likely to end up. But, certainly the rating of funds has been an issue. And, the sweeping of funds in this, the debate in this budget has really been about getting between now and July 1st. Would Governor Hassan have the ability to tap dedicated funds to balance the present budget? It's an open question whether that would even be required given, recent strength in revenues in the last month. But that was what the debate was this time. It was for this budget that we're now in. It wasn't prospective.
I recall the upper limit on that for the deficit was about $41 million, but it may actually be significantly lower than that once the final numbers are in. So that doesn't mean all $41 million would come from these funds, but the idea is to in part sweep these dedicated accounts in order to get at least some millions of dollars to help fill that deficit.
Yeah, and Ben, I know in your paper, the Concord Monitor, this has prompted a lot of letters to the editor, a lot of editorials. I mean, people like our caller are kind of upset about this. And yet, every governor does it, right? I mean, unusual for a governor to just leave these funds alone.
Right. You can call it a sweep, you can call it a raid, but using money from these dedicated funds isn't something that hasn't happened before. The question is the deficit for the current year, as Josh and Dean said, and it was $41 million, a shortfall in revenue at the end of February. That we had very strong revenue numbers in March, something like $26.6 million above what had been planned. So that number is down a lot. But Maggie Hassan has asked for authority to raid whatever funds she wants to help fill that deficit.
So that's a widening of what governors usually do.
And it's specific authority that a lot of folks, especially Republicans in the legislature, are uncomfortable with because they say it cedes a lot of the legislative power to the governor. Now, the House budget modifies that power somewhat. It requires her to get permission from something called the Fiscal Committee at the legislature, which is bicameral, bipartisan. It's a body that has both Republicans and Democrats on, I believe, in equal numbers that would be able to approve this. But there was a proposal during the debate on the House floor on Wednesday to protect 12 specific funds from being raided, including the LCHIP fund, a program that's been very popular. And that proposal only failed by one vote. It was the closest that Republicans came to attaching an amendment to the budget. It still failed, but that was something that quite a few Democrats defected on.
All right. Well, again, thanks for that call, Chris. Big issue. Our number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. On our roundup today, we're wrapping up some of the news at the State House that you likely heard about, but we'll also be looking at other stories in a few minutes, including the first hepatitis C Exeter hospital cases going to trial. Also, the news that new refugees will be coming to Manchester and Nashua. And later on, the possibility of former Massachusetts U.S. Senator Scott Brown running for U.S. Senate here in New Hampshire. Join us on those stories and more in our roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And gentlemen, let's take another call. This is Theo in Manchester. Hi, Theo. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Go ahead.
I wanted to make a comment about university funding. I'm a college student here in New Hampshire, and I'm also the president of the New Hampshire Young Democrats. And we are very concerned about university funding because I think it's the key to the state's economic future. And we're now 50th in states in the United States in how we fund our university, public university system. And I think Governor Hassan did a great job in her budget and in her campaign making that central, and that House Democrats did a great job in restoring some of that funding.
Some of it, although not as much as what the governor wanted.
Restore more of it.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question, Theo, if I could. Governor Hassan was able to restore it, as you put it, as much as she did because she's relying on $80 million from a potential casino. How do you feel about that? Is that an acceptable trade-off, more university funding, but you bring in a casino to pay for it?
That's an interesting and difficult question that I think the legislature is really going to have to wrestle with and balance the potential social cost of what a casino would bring and see if it really does bring in the revenue that it would promise.
Okay. Theo, thanks a lot.
I think we'll have to look at that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot for calling in. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Keep those emails short. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And gentlemen, before we move away from Statehouse news, there was another Statehouse item that I want to ask you all about. And Josh Rogers, to you first. This week, Governor Hassan released her nominee for Attorney General, former Nashua State Senator Joe Foster. Was this a surprise announcement, Josh?
I mean, in some ways, yes, in that Senator Foster, who served both in the Senate and the House, lacks any background as a prosecutor. So to that degree, it was somewhat surprising. But on the other hand, no, he's a well-regarded lawyer and an ally of Governor Hassan's. And he was tight with Governor Lynch as well and, well-regarded around Concord. But it's an interesting pick in that Senator Foster doesn't have any prosecutorial experience. You have to go back for a while to find a governor who went with somebody like that. I think Judd Gregg may have been the last when he appointed John Arnold. But you know, he's well regarded, and it may be, you know, maybe it's a good thing. Certainly there are those who believe that the Attorney General's office focuses a little too much on sort of blood and guts sort of crimes to some degree, to the detriment of other you know, the civil matters. And so it'll be interesting to see how that goes. I mean, there's no doubt that Senator Foster is going to be confirmed.
That's what I wanted to ask you. So the executive council
it seems pretty likely. I mean, he's well regarded. He's respected in Concord. It is interesting that he's going to be coming out of one of the bigger law firms of the state, the McLean Law Firm, and they have a lot of clients that do business with the state. And there have been some questions about how that will work itself out. But it looks like he's going to be the next Attorney General.
Yeah. Dean, what's your take on Joe Foster?
One of the interesting aspects of it is his political experience. He was in the House of Representatives. He was a state senator. He was Senate Majority Leader 2006 to 2008. And so while he may not have prosecutorial experience, you think about the tense relationship between Attorney General Delaney and Republicans in the state legislature. It might not be a bad idea to have somebody who has that sort of comfort level dealing with kind of the whole sort of legislative culture at the state house. And also there was this concern that, you know, Delaney was leaving because he had been opposed to gambling and Hassan wants gambling in her budget. And, you know, Joe Foster is someone who is in 2005, he voted against video slots, and he was the vice chair of that committee that did a report on gambling that said you needed more regulation. So it in a sense, choosing him doesn't make it look like she's getting somebody who's in the bag on gambling, because while he's not been a big opponent, he's sort of been mildly opposed to it. So I think it neutralizes that issue a little bit as well. But I think the political experience is probably a plus for her. And, you know, he is a Democrat. Executive council is 3-2 in favor of Democrats. So, you know, the assumption is he'll be confirmed.
Yeah, interesting. And Ben, that gambling issue was an issue that a lot of reporters picked up on, because some people felt like that's why Michael Delaney chose to leave at this point in time, because he wasn't comfortable with this push from Hassan for gambling.
Well, and the Attorney General's office has traditionally, and this year as well, opposed proposals for casino gambling because of public safety concerns. There's no sign that if he's confirmed, Joe Foster would change that stance. He's someone who has been considered somewhat wary of expanded gambling, though in his time in the state Senate, as far as I can tell, there wasn't an up or down vote on a casino proposal anywhere similar to the one that's now proposed. There was that proposal for video slots that he did vote against, but that didn't get that didn't get much support in the Senate even at the time. So he's not someone with he is someone who's deeply engaged with the issue of gambling. He was vice chair of that study commission that Governor Lynch appointed and that Governor Lynch cited in eventually declaring that he was opposed to expanded gambling and would veto a bill to do it. He's not someone with a long history as a supporter or an opponent of the issue.
I want to ask you one more question on this issue of public safety, Ben, and that has to do with prison privatization. The state recently decided, I think it was this week, to not explore private prisons anymore. They'd been talking about it. There'd been some opposition. Maggie Hassan wasn't wild about it. What was the deal breaker, Ben, there?
Well, the state had put out bids to see what ideas were out there, what companies were out there to various privatization schemes. And these could include building one new joint men's and women's prison, building new separate prisons, perhaps even building a prison that would then be leased back to the state for the state to operate. That last option is the only one that Governor Hassan has indicated she would support. The House has gone on record opposed to any privately run prison. They've passed a bill that's now gone to the Senate to ban prison privatization in the state. And when the bids came in, they were studied at great length. And this week, the state canceled the bid, saying that none of the proposals were very good. They didn't meet the state's standards under various legal requirements to care for inmates, and that the salaries and benefits for people who would work at the prisons were significantly lower than what people at the prisons now enjoy, which doesn't mean that the state officials don't think we need a new women's prison especially, but that prison privatization doesn't look like it's going to be the way to go from here on out.
Wow.
Real quick, the backdrop to all of this is this idea of consent decrees and court orders, the idea that there is clearly pressure on the system, often imposed by the courts, to meet a certain minimum level of standards on education, mental health, things like that, and to the extent that these particular bids weren't able to fulfill those court orders. And there's also this class action lawsuit about women's prisons and providing equal benefits for women to the male prison population. So there is this sort of backdrop of kind of the courts and court orders requiring that the state meet a certain minimum level, and these bids clearly didn't do that.
All right. Again, our number for you to join us on these topics and more in our weekly news roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. Now, since Dean mentioned, Josh, a big piece of infrastructure, the new women's prison that seems to be coming. Bridges on the seacoast, Josh, have been in the news, it seems, for the past 3 or 4 months. This latest damage this week to the Sarah Long Bridge, it was struck by a vessel. How did this happen, Josh?
Well, it seems like a tanker, cut loose from its pier and full of beef tallow into the side of the old Sarah Long Bridge. And
full of beef tallow.
And it's looking like it's going to be, $1 million plus in damages, and the bridge isn't going to be open for, a month or so. And, the bridge has been taking a beating lately. Its drawbridge went up and couldn't come down earlier in the year. It's the number one red list bridge on the transportation plan, and, more bad luck.
Yeah, and who has to pay to fix this, Josh? New Hampshire, Maine, the
company? I'm assuming an insurance company. But,
I think the company, right,
yeah.
of that beef tallow boat, which is something you don't hear about every day. I do wonder, though, Josh, how this incident, how the struggles of bridges on the seacoast play into State Representative David Campbell's push for higher gas taxes. He's been saying, look, we need more money to fix these bridges. I wonder if this bolsters his case or not.
I'm not sure the beef tallow argument is likely to be sort of introduced as this moves on in the Senate, but, it does continue focus on the costs of maintaining infrastructure.
Yeah, what do you think about this, Ben? There has been a lot of news about bridges over on the seacoast.
Well, and after the Sarah Long Bridge had its initial problem this year, which was that, as Josh said, it went up and couldn't come
right
down for quite a while, that's something that became a part of Governor Hassan's rhetoric when she talks about the need to invest in our transportation infrastructure, saying that, very early in her tenure as governor, we stopped having more than one bridge across to Maine and down in Portsmouth. Of course, the new Memorial Bridge will be done this summer. But she did not include money for transportation infrastructure in her budget. She said that we can look at the casino, we can look at the gas tax. I haven't ruled anything out. I think this will be one more piece of argument that's used by supporters of the gas tax. I'm not sure it's likely to help that argument at all. The Senate has made clear that it's not going to be giving this much of a chance.
Dead on arrival, I think, is what they've said about the gas tax.
Yes.
All right, lots more to talk about after a short break, including the news this week that new refugees will be coming to Manchester and Nashua. We'll look at that. Also, some interesting news in national politics. Will Scott Brown run for U.S. Senate here in New Hampshire? We'll talk about that after a short break, so stay with us.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and Dana-Farber New Hampshire Oncology, Hematology, and Londonderry, bringing Dana-Farber's expertise closer to you, danafarber.org/Londonderry. And Waste Management, with a reminder to practice the 4 R's wherever possible, reduce, reuse, recycle, and recover the resource. Additional information at thinkgreen.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
You may not be able to tell by the weather, but it is spring, a time when we all start clearing out the clutter we've accumulated over the cold months. If you have an old car that you'd like to clear out but don't know what to do with, donate it to NHPR. We take care of everything, the paperwork, the pickup. All you have to do is sign the dotted line and accept your charitable gift receipt. Put a spring in your step with a gift to your favorite public radio station. Call 1-877-393-NHPR or visit nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, our Sky Guys join us for an astronomy update. You can email us your questions for them before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us Monday morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, it's a New Hampshire News Roundup, and we've been looking at some of the stories that Granite Staters were talking about this week. These include the differences between the House and Senate budget, also Governor Hassan nominating former Nashua State Senator Joe Foster for Attorney General, and problems with bridges on the seacoast. You can join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. We're also going to be covering in just a moment the announcement that new refugees will be coming to Manchester and Nashua, and the possibility of former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown running for office here in New Hampshire. But first, Dean Spiliotis, I did want to ask you about a major news item. The first hepatitis C cases are scheduled for trial concerning people who were injured by Exeter Hospital, an employee there. Just remind us of how huge a deal this was a while back.
Right. It's a very big deal. This was the case where the traveling medical technician who had been to about 18 different hospitals infected patients at Exeter Hospital by swapping out drugs for saline in various needles. And what we've seen is that the first civil trials in this are set for 2014, and we're seeing a lot of legal activity. There was this gathering of about 40 lawyers for the hospitals and patients recently. They all met at Rockingham County Superior Court to try to set up a schedule for something like 25 civil suits. And whenever you see that, you typically see lawyers trying to settle up front. So we're already seeing some patients get undisclosed settlements now to basically avoid civil trials later on. So even though the trials are until 2014, I think we're going to see a lot of kind of legal activity as lawyers try to settle as many of these as possible for whatever they decide is a reasonable sum.
So they don't go to trial.
Right, so they don't go to trial. Instead of 25 trials, maybe reduce that number.
Well, and joining us now by phone is someone who's been watching this issue really closely, Jason Claffey, local editor of New Hampshire Patch. He's been covering the hepatitis C cases at Exeter Hospital. And Jason, thanks for giving us a couple of your minutes, of your time this morning.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, who are the injured parties here then, Jason? And how many people are we talking about? I mean, Dean mentioned 25 cases, but does each case represent a person or several persons?
Well, 32 Exeter Hospital patients contracted hepatitis C. Many of those patients have filed lawsuits against the hospital and also two staffing agencies that placed David Kwiatkowski. He's the medical technician who prosecutors say stole medication that was meant for their patients, and he would inject the medication sort of to get high and then replace it with a saline solution. So many of those patients, you know, in addition to being involved in these lawsuits, they're, you know, battling hepatitis C, which is a potentially deadly liver disease.
Yeah, it's awful for them. And you mentioned these suits are against the hospital, against the staffing agencies that brought this person to Exeter Hospital. So no one's suing him himself, Jason, is that right?
Right, because the hospitals and the staffing agencies, they are sort of the bigger targets. Mr. Kwiatkowski himself is already facing 98 years in jail and $3.5 million worth of fines.
So not a lot of money there, yeah.
Right, right. So the hospital, if you're a lawyer, the hospital and the staffing agencies are sort of where you're going to get the most compensation for your clients.
Well, and Jason, one last question for you, please. As Dean Spiliotis said, the trials are right now set to begin in November of 2014. That seems like a long time, especially for these folks who are really suffering, as you said.
It is a long time, and it's, you know, that's sort of how the court system works. It's, you know, a very long process, and this is such a complicated case. Like you said, there's at least 26 separate lawsuits and dozens of lawyers working on this. So it's definitely unprecedented.
Okay. Well, thank you again for being with us, Jason. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
That's Jason Claffey, again, local editor of New Hampshire Patch. He covered extensively the hepatitis C cases at Exeter Hospital. The number for you to join our New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. We want your comments, questions, and thoughts about some of the issues in state news that we've been discussing and what issues are front and center in your mind this week. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And gentlemen, I want to ask you about a news item that was just hit the news this morning. And Josh Rogers, that's the possibility that former Massachusetts U.S. Senator Scott Brown, a Republican, may run for U.S. Senate here in New Hampshire. How would he do that?
Well, my understanding is a requirement that simply that you register to vote, and that would qualify you to run. He does have a house on the seacoast and has spent time here through the years. I mean, essentially, what he said was he was asked about this possibility last night, and he said, "I'm not ruling anything out."
Yeah, he didn't
say I'm running. You know, certainly Democrats didn't waste much time in terms of both doing a fundraising solicitation and also a sort of a parody Twitter account was set up late last night. Scott Brown, New Hampshire. Don't know who exactly is behind that, but featuring the former senator's famous sort of cosmopolitan shot where he's sort of posing topless. And
Cosmopolitan, but, the magazine,
yes,
the women's magazine.
Yes, he was a male model before he was a senator. I mean, certainly, you know, one reason why people are paying attention to this is, you know, obviously Scott Brown's was a, you know, sort of a celebrity of candidate of 2010, and you know, obviously he was defeated by Elizabeth Warren, but nobody stepped up to face incumbent Democrat Gene Shaheen, and so we're waiting for a candidate to emerge on that front, and certainly Scott Brown is an interesting notion. You know, it's not without, you know, sort of Daniel Webster in reverse, I guess. He was a member of Congress from New Hampshire before he served Senate in Massachusetts, but there are also examples of people who've, you know, kind of carpet-bagged up here and failed.
Well, and Hillary Clinton was a U.S. senator from New York, but with sort of loose ties to New York, and she managed to get in.
Yes. So we'll see. I mean, it certainly is, you know, very interesting for the moment. We'll see if it happens.
Well, and you mentioned Democrats and their reaction to this. Our friend and colleague Kevin Landrigan tweeted this morning, New Hampshire Democratic Chair Ray Buckley wastes no time turning ex-GOP Senator Scott Brown event into a plea for party cash. So, Kevin, thanks for that tweet. What do you think about this, Ben Lubsdorf? There's some history here. I mean, as Josh says, other people have done this, too. It's not unprecedented.
Well, I'm glad you asked because it gives me the chance to say the name Chubb Peabody. Chubb Peabody, whose real first name was Endicott, which I'm not sure is better, was the governor of Massachusetts. He was a Democrat in the 1960s, well-known on civil rights. He later in his life moved to New Hampshire and ran for the U.S. Senate in 1986 against Warren Rubman, losing quite badly. So he's an example of someone who was an elected official in another state, came to New Hampshire, and did not succeed in being elected. So that C word, carpetbagger, does get attached there. And you mentioned Hillary Clinton. It's true. She had very loose ties to New York when she ran for the Senate there. She was from Illinois. She had lived in Arkansas for obviously a long time and in Washington, D.C. She had never been an elected official from those places, though. And I think that gives you it creates more questions in people's minds, especially given that this would be, if Scott Brown did run against Gene Shaheen, something like his third Senate race in 5 years, less than 5 years. He was elected in a special election, then lost a regular election.
And he's a freshly minted sort of Fox News commentator, and also you know, joined a big law firm lobbying shop in Massachusetts. So,
since he lost his last race, yeah. Well, is this for real, Dean, or is this just journalist chattering?
It's probably a little bit of each. I mean, I think, you know, as far as Scott Brown is concerned, I mean, it gives you a sense of how, you know, once you've made it to the big show in Washington and then you don't get to go, you really want to find a way to get back. I've seen this with a lot of politicians. And there is always a danger to looking like you're sort of perennially running for office because you really want to be an elected member to Congress. You know, the biggest challenge for me would be getting comfortable with the idea of Scott Brown talking about what's important to New Hampshire residents, right? We don't have a long history of Scott Brown weighing in on issues that are important to New Hampshire. Now, he could kind of make an argument about, you know, some of these national issues affect all of New England. But it would take a real kind of adjustment, I think, in people's kind of frames of reference for him. And Gene Shaheen is going to be a tough candidate. And I don't know that the demographics here are all that much different that it would necessarily favor him. But it sure is fun to speculate about it.
Well, and there was no speculation in Manchester and Nashua this week, Dean. It was announced that more refugees are coming to those cities. 200 to Manchester, 50 to Nashua. What was the reaction from those cities, Dean?
This is interesting. This has been going on for several years. People may recognize this issue. About 2 years ago, Mayor Ted Gatsis of Manchester had asked the U.S. State Department for a one-year moratorium on refugee resettlement because he felt that the city services were being overwhelmed and that they weren't able to appropriately deal with the influx of new residents. The State Department said no. This time around, as you mentioned, it'll be 50 going to Nashua, others going to Manchester. You know, some concern from Nashua's mayor that they may not be fully set up to deal with the influx. But you know, it's gonna happen regardless, and it's something that Nashua, as the second largest city in the state, now has to deal with.
Nashua really hasn't had a lot of
Manchester
refugees.
Typically has gotten, I think, about 60% of the refugees. So over the last 10 years, I saw a figure we've had about 3,000 refugees, and Manchester's gotten about 1,800. Concord's gotten a fair number in the hundreds as well. This is something that a number of cities in the state are dealing with, and it's pretty clear that as far as the federal government is concerned, it's going to continue.
Yeah, it's duly noted that this is a State Department program.
Right.
Cities don't really have that much say in who, what, when, where.
Right. They're resettled by, there's a nonprofit agency called the International Institute of New England that does the actual resettlement. But the sort of the ultimate arbiter here is the federal government. It's a kind of a fascinating study in the relationship between, you know, state and federal law and the kind of the relative power of the two.
Well, and Josh, I want to completely do a 180 and talk about a very local story that did make waves, though, across the state this week. That's the town of Windham, where the school board banned dodgeball. And boy, I've seen lots of talk about this.
Well, passions run deep when it comes to dodgeball, Laura. But I mean, I guess,
why did they,
you know,
do this?
Well, I mean, the thinking was is that you know, what the school board deemed so-called human target activities are, you know, detrimental to you know, proper development of all students. And you know, that was the vote of, that was a 4-1 vote, and you know, the children of the dissenting school board member are petitioning to reinstate dodgeball. It's something a lot of people played. I sure as heck played a lot of it in the Concord school system, and you know, maybe the scars are deep and will come out later, but we'll see where this goes. And, you know, this has obviously gotten some national traction.
Yeah, well, and some kids were being targeted for repeated hits with bullying. You know, it's not sort of an equal opportunity hit. I mean, there were certain kids who were being singled out and targeted, and that was the concern of their parents. But you're right, Josh, there was a reaction on the other side. I think some kids even said, look, we're not really using those hard rubber balls that maybe you and I used, you know. They're using a lot softer stuff there. So this led to cries of nanny state and so forth. Dean Spiliotis?
You know, there's a second kind of narrative in here that, you know, we have in our culture now, there's an increasing movement away from having clear winners and losers. You know, it's about participation and fairness. So one of the complaints was not only that it's human targeting, but that it's an elimination game. So if you're the first one out, you basically sit while all the rest of the kids get to play. And so that's kind of the other issue in there. I mean, I don't know if this is going to sweep across New Hampshire, but you do see these kinds of debates in school boards around the country.
Well, and one last issue, and Ben, I'm going to throw it to you. The House last week or the week before passed a bill extending the hours that people could drink in New Hampshire. Instead of last call at 1 o'clock, the House said, sure, go out and party until 2 o'clock in the morning. Now the Senate's going to have to vote on this. What do you think they're going to do?
I think that's an open question. You know, I think that the vote in the House to pass this bill was surprisingly strong. There was surprisingly little opposition to the idea. Now it goes to the Senate. They held a hearing this week at the Senate Commerce Committee and heard quite a bit of testimony from law enforcement groups who are opposed to this. The State Liquor Commission, the police chiefs are opposed to this because they believe it will lead to an increase in alcohol-related crime, drunk driving. The argument from the other side, from supporters of this bill, is that 46 states have later last calls than New Hampshire.
46 states, wow.
And so if there is an epidemic of drunk driving, we would probably see it in those other states. One of the sponsors of the bill said that the bill is, if it were a fine wine, it would have a pro-business bouquet and a liberty finish. So it'll be interesting to see where the Senate comes down on this. It'll be interesting to see how they balance the pro-business arguments versus the public safety concerns.
And one of the provisions that made it that seemingly, I think, helped its popularity in the House was that it contained this local option where if a community wanted to opt out of the later closing time, it could. That may not help it in the Senate, where the law enforcement types are saying, well, you know, we need to have uniformity and let's just leave things the way they are. But you know, this is the kind of issue where, you know, on a long day in the House when you've got a million bills, like, you know, I've seen many bills like this where it sort of makes the reps feel good to pass something. It's an open question whether this can get through the Senate.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will definitely probably be looking at that at a later news roundup. But, gentlemen, just looking ahead to next week, Dean Spiliotis, what are some of the maybe just one big issue that you're going to be watching next week?
I'm looking to see if Manchester is going to get all of its taxi cabs back. I don't know if you heard the story about the city, Manchester police taking all 18 cabs off of Manchester streets. I think six of them needed to be towed, which is a little bit of a scary thought. The biggest surprise for me was I didn't realize that Manchester only had 18 cabs. I had this assumption that, you know, there are these big cab companies, but it's a legitimate inconvenience for people who either don't drive or can't own cars and need taxis to get around. Everyone knows people who are like that. So it's kind of an amusing story, but it actually sort of has kind of a serious underpinning in terms of, you know, affordable access to transportation in the largest city in the state. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see if they can get the taxis up and running again.
All right. And how about you, Ben?
Well, on Wednesday, the Executive Council is going to be holding its public hearing on Joe Foster's nomination for Attorney General. And as Josh said, the assumption is that he's going to be confirmed easily by the council. But if there's anything that we don't know about Joe Foster now, it'll probably come out then. There have been those concerns, as Josh said, about he works for McLean Law Firm, a very large law firm with a lot of clients in the state. We might hear more about that then. And also, the counselors will have a chance to ask him some questions, perhaps about his lack of prosecuting experience.
All right. So you'll be looking at that.
Yes.
All right. And much other activity, too, at the State House, I'm guessing, Ben. There's a lot going on there. Josh, how about you? Some of the big stories that you'll be covering next week.
Well, I haven't sorted it all out yet, but I will be looking, as I seemingly have been all year long, to see, what sort of push is going to be made on the gambling front of the House. We still don't know when that bill is going to be heard. And, basically there's a lot of attention on that. And it'll be interesting to see how and when that ultimately happens.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being here, Josh. I appreciate it.
Anytime, Laura.
Josh Rogers, NHPR State House reporter, senior political reporter and editor. And Ben Lubsdorf, thank you for being with us. I appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
Ben Lubsdorf, staff reporter at the Concord Monitor. Dean Spiliotis, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with our astronomy experts on some of the news from space science, from the giant meteor that exploded over Russia to new hopes for Mars exploration. Then talk of tightening up New Hampshire's campaign finance laws after an election year that saw huge amounts of outside money. And the latest thinking on bullying, responding to it and preventing it. Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show with the